Hey everyone, welcome to our weekly edition of the Out of the Woods Threat Hunting Podcast. This is Scott Poley here with Tom Costura.
Hello everybody.
And this weekly segment features the top stories that threat hunters need to be thinking about, as well as our thoughts on the subject and hunting strategies. So with that, let's dive into the top threat hunting headlines for the week of April 15th, 2025. What do you got for us, Tom?
All right, kicking it off today. So we have an article out of Semantic Security. It's titled Shuckworm, also known as Gamerodon, and it's titled Ukraine Targeting with Gamma Steel Stealer. So the threat actor Shuckworm was identified between February and March of this year with a campaign focused on Ukraine, targeting specifically the military mission of a Western country based in the Eastern European nation, so particularly focused around cyber espionage. There are some interesting pieces here, so I'm going to kind of walk through a bit of the infection process to talk through it a little bit. And basically, the way that this was occurring was through infected removable drives containing malicious LNK shortcut files, which was identified from evidence of the modification of the user assist register key. So I'm going to kind of circle back to that one later because I think that's an interesting little artifact. The infection chain is triggered when a user interacts with that infected USB, and the LNK files are weaponized with embedded PowerShell commands that execute in the background, making the attack pretty stealthy and requiring minimal user interaction. And the LNK files may appear as normal looking documents or folders to kind of increase the likelihood of execution. So naming conventions, things we've seen before. Once the LNK file is clicked, it runs an obfuscated PowerShell script that initiates the Gamma Steel InfoStealer. And the PowerShell script is multi-stage. The first stage downloads and drops the second stage payload, which includes the actual stealer and additional scripts for persistence and data collection. And PowerShell is used not just for the execution, but for handling. So things like downloading payloads from the remote URLs, or the C2, executing commands for recon of the environment and doing some exfil from that, would do so by creating like a snapshot of the machine. It would run system info commands, generate file lists for specific locations and more. And then it would exfil that collected data, leveraging PowerShell web request. And if that were to fail, it would immediately fall back to using curl over a Tor network proxy to kind of help obfuscate the origin IP. So some of the kind of stealth tactics used, the scripts perform basic checks before proceeding. So basically making sure it's in the right OS, right architecture, has the right privileges, et cetera. Ensuring that the payloads aren't wasted in an environment it can't detonate it in. The malware creates files and directories with names that mimic legitimate Windows artifacts. So one example is the payload file being named ntuser.dat.tmcontainer with random numbers at the end, really to aid in hiding in plain sight and, looking not suspicious. And interestingly, the execution flow avoids downloading large binaries directly. And instead, it kind of stages a bunch of small scripts to incrementally assemble the payload or retrieve the payload, both. And, none of this leveraged any known like vulnerabilities or exploits. And instead, it just really kind of relied on the living off the land tools and happening with native OS features. So like PowerShell, WMI, schedule tasks, things like that. So it could just kind of stay low noise, hard to detect, nice and quiet. But yeah, the Shuckworm tactics have seemingly shifted. They would historically rely more on heavy VBS script usage. And now this kind of shift to PowerShell-based tools is really kind of one of the core points of this article. Likely for a couple of reasons, like being able to be more low profile, aid in detection evasion. Also because it allows it to store scripts in the registry more effectively, which was heavily shown, and the evidence was heavily shown in this article. So yeah, quite a few interesting points in this write-up. One thing that stood out to me was the modification of some of the different register keys. So things that we don't typically see or talk about, Scott. So the user assist one, although, I think we've touched on this before, or at least seen it before, it's not something we commonly talk about. So I thought it was worth mentioning. There were also a couple other registry keys in there that were, not the typical ones we see. And, the the seemingly embedded function to infect removable media. So this would also propagate by looking to infect files that were moved from the system to additional removable media. And it would do so like in a hidden fashion, which I thought was also pretty cool. But, you know, all of that said, Scott, I'll take a quick breath and see what you thought of this one.
Yeah, no, so there were some interesting kind of behaviors in there. Obviously, there's a lot of activity because, like you said, there was like the breakup of how it assembled things, right? And for, you know, that to happen, there has to be things constantly going on, at least initially. One of the things I thought was really interesting was just the specific nature and how targeted this was. So when they did the WMI command to basically Win32 ping status, where they literally were targeting mil.gov.ua, that was interesting just because it's always, because if that fails, right, there was no ping stored or the ping was unsuccessful to that domain, which is a government domain, Ukraine, it would stop at execution, right? So that's interesting because it is so targeted, and sometimes if it's opportunistic or just standard criminal activity, they kind of would like maybe want to know what their target is, but if they happen to land somewhere that's opportunistic, they still would collect data. And in this case, that's not the case. So I thought that was kind of interesting to kind of put your head in the mindset of how aggressive they were at its specific target. The big thing, obviously, looking at the curl with Tor functionality, one of the things is they did provide a really good like command line for what that looks like. And obviously, if you ever use curl legitimately, you often don't use as many arguments and flags and things to that nature, like you would see there. So it's good to kind of pay attention to some of those things because those would stand out as well. And the other thing, too, there was a lot of instances where MSHTA was running. And one of the things I think it's really good to pay attention to is when you actually see a script being passed to that, because a lot of times files will be passed for things to be executed, but when you actually see a full script being passed to like a WScript or MSHTA, it's more suspicious because that's not the native way a lot of those things are typically run. And also in this case, you'll actually see where MSHTA is running JavaScript to run WScript, so like just the execution chain is interesting. I've always talked in the past about how you have like daisy chaining of script interpreter based executables together is always a good thing to look for. One of the things too I liked was, you know, they talked about using PowerShell and storing in the registry, like you mentioned. Something to note on that, and this isn't easy to do. Well, it can be. It depends on your logging, but it depends on how you log specific things too. Registry keys are usually hard to log because you have to be targeted because it can create a lot of noise. But if you're able to store the actual values and you're able to store enough of the values, it can be very telling as well. So if you're going to store a PowerShell in a registry key, it's oftentimes going to be base64 encoded for one. The reason for that is you can't use certain special characters in registry keys. Otherwise, it won't store correctly. So the other thing is if it's a script, it's going to be really long. So sometimes you might be able to, if you have the correct visibility and you're looking at the right spots, to say, hey, do I have a registry key that is greater than a certain length? And then based on identification and you see the keys, you'll be able to tell, hey, this looks like it's base64 encoded, and you know it could be a script. So that's something to kind of keep an eye out for. The other thing I thought was really interesting was the knowledge base of understanding how to enable all the hidden attributes, because they, you know, move a lot of files around and they try to keep them hidden. And to do so, there's three registry keys. Like one of them I knew about, the other two I really didn't, but that's what makes it interesting to me is they're all in the current user Hive under software, Microsoft Windows current version, Explore Advanced, but there's three different registry keys. There's hidden, show super hidden, and hide file extension or EXT. And it's good to know, like, they're looking at those three in combination. So it's kind of a good fingerprint if something is modifying those. That's a, a telltale sign. But also, there are other things that maybe if you were looking at this way to detect when people try to hide things or make the system hide things for them, now you have some additional keys to look at if in that case. They kind of build out any kind of hunts you might be doing based off that. The other thing that usually, when I talked about script-based things, you know, if you use WScript or MSHTA and you're passing like a script to it, not a file, that's one thing. But also seeing files passed with weird extensions that you wouldn't expect to see is also an interesting sign. So, for instance, one of the files that it drops and runs is WScript, and then it's a, you know, path to a .drv, right? More of a driver. You usually don't run drivers from WScript. So that in itself is kind of suspicious. And then you also see instances where PowerShell is actually running and doing a sleep, which is, you know, it's interesting to do a sleep on PowerShell. It's not terribly interesting, but in combination with that, they actually are using a Discord variable, right? The new object system net.web client kind of download. And I don't think it is truly Discord. I'm not sure based on the IP space and look it up, but they use the variable name of Discord. So that's why I say that. So, you know, some interesting PowerShell one-liners that you might be able to find. And then also they did use cert util to hash files, the files that they were stealing or taking inventory of, or however you want to look at it. And that's also interesting because you might have certain processes or things that might use cert util for this functionality natively that maybe run. I don't see a lot of that in general, but also if you were to see an uptick of this on a system, because I'm not positive, but I don't know if you could just feed it a list of files, right? I feel like you have to feed it individual files to hash. So you would see a bunch of executions if there were a batch of files that you were going to run this on. So there's just some kind of characteristics that I thought were worth mentioning because I think they can be detectable or you can build things around that.
Yeah, and you know, I'm curious, is I don't think I see this that often, at least as I've kind of tracked back through last handful of months of notes, but what did you think also, and have you seen this pretty prevalent from your side, Scott, where they're leveraging the Windows Update reg key to kind of like lock in the C2 command or C2 server address? I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, no, I haven't seen that, but I think it's what's interesting in general is they seem to use components of the Windows registry or Windows system layout as they're intended to be used in a way, you know? So you can't just go based on rare activity on those locations or spots. So I think that's just kind of, like I said, like they knew all the three different hidden file or hidden things in the registry to call out to make sure they can enable those correctly. So they clearly know a lot about how Windows works when they built this and scaled this attack. So that's noteworthy as far as what things to maybe, you know, keep an eye on in the future as far as what they adapt to, what they learn next.
Yeah, for sure. Last little nugget before I pass it on to you that I did have as a sub note here. The malicious script exfiltrates some of the data from the infected machine, as I kind of talked about before, some of the system info data, host name, things like that, actually stacks them inside of the user agent HTTP request header. I thought that was pretty cool too.
Yeah, which, you know,
that way.
There's ways to, if you're actually looking at user agent, which I think is great data to look at, it's just you have to understand enough of it to like reduce the noise or know how to do it at scale. But it's always good to look at user agent data if you have that data. Can be telling sometimes. And obviously. So, yeah.
All right, Scott. What do you got going next for us today?
So, the one I have for us is from Bizone. So, Bizone Threat Intelligence, the specific report is talking about Sapphire Werewolf. It's kind of someone who they keep a close eye on. But basically, they had some recent findings showing that they are using an updated version of the Amethyst Stealer. It's an open source malware distributed via phishing emails, but in this campaign they specifically were looking at, they were actually cluster targeting energy companies. So like I said, sometimes the victimization is interesting based on what would they want to do with that data, or maybe who is asking or on the marketplace saying, hey, anyone have this kind of data that, you know, sometimes drives some of these campaigns. But there's actually a lot of interesting things to note about it. But one of the things as I was going through this that I thought would be a good detection. So I'm going to kind of walk through where my head was going versus the reality and kind of the gotchas there. But, you know, one of the things that's interesting is it's using phishing. So .rar compression file, right? Compressed file. And when I see .rar, it immediately kind of puts my focus on different parts of the world. I've talked about this before, but it seems like more non-US uses .rar and US uses, you know, zip or 7-zip. So by seeing .rar, I kind of have an idea of maybe what the targeted energy companies might be. But just that's just kind of anecdotal. But it basically unpacks an exe with the PDF icon, you know, to kind of trick people. And then that runs a .NET loader to kind of make it harder to detect. But one of the interesting things they called out was it had a canary token in there. And I know we've talked about canary tokens, if not on weekly stuff, but definitely on the live podcast, where we kind of dug into like a really cool tool to kind of build tripwires when someone passes something. Because the idea of the canary token, if someone steals a file with it, for instance, that token will call back with all the information of the system that opened that file. So now you know someone took it and you know something about them. Well, it looks like they registered a canary token to run in their stuff to help them collect information. So kind of interesting that they were utilizing that. And the other thing to note is the information from canary tokens is passed over DNS. So that being said, it's also a trick, I'm gonna say tricky, but a stealthy way to get information, even from networks that might be more closed off, right? If they don't have access to the internet, usually DNS or sometimes DNS is still open. They'll know at least that information. But the other thing too, it does touch some registry keys, basically looking for registry keys that contain, well, they have specific keys, but the keys that contain VMware and VBox for VirtualBox, trying to identify, you know, some standard sandbox or virtual environments, right? And then it does a series of WMI commands. And so this is where I was kind of thinking like, well, gosh, it makes that much noise. This will be interesting because I assumed right off the bat, a lot of times when I see a lot of profiling, a lot of discovery happening, I'm like, well, there's going to be a lot of execution, right? And so I'm like, well, this would be easy. You can almost say within a time interval, do we have X number of executions of, you know, the executable that runs WMI? That was my first thought. And then as I dug into it, I realized that that actually isn't the case, because everything they're profiling, and typically when you do discovery with WMI, you're bouncing off the same namespace. And so that means typically the executable that runs WMI only runs and stays running for a specific namespace. So if it were to query multiple namespaces out of that database or whatever of information, there would be multiple executions, but in this case, there won't be. So then you start kind of becoming pretty limited at this point, because the report just talks about it just touches a couple keys that you may or may not be monitoring for just reading, not necessarily modifying, right? So I was like, man, this is actually pretty tricky, because it does a lot of due diligence to make sure it's on a box that it wants to infect based on some of the things. And when it does, it focuses on stealing, you know, Telegram credentials, various browsers, credentials and things out of that as well. FileZilla and SSH configurations, also configuration files for remote desktops and VPNs. And then it will steal some various types of documents, including stuff if there's external media attached, right? So I don't know if that also includes network drives, but so... And then there was some guidance in the report. And this is what was interesting. Like, I mean, I realize they're not going to try to give everything away, right? But when I first looked at this report, I'm like, wow, this is really a good write-up to understand some of the activity. But once again, like, I realize there's not great ways to identify this behavior or the behaviors there. And so they offer some suggestions, which are good, right? Suspicious executable files from a temp folder. That's something you should kind of be looking for in general. So, you know, reasonable there. Executables resembling system files from unusual folders. Another great thing, you know, we've done it where we just created a mass list from the system files and said anything not running from their typical location. It's not a bad thing to look for. They created scheduled tasks for some of their persistence, but they didn't really talk about that too much. Opening sensitive files from unusual processes. I mean, that's kind of a tough one to look at because you have to know a lot going into that, and that changes over time. So I did some additional research specifically on this to see if there was any of additional artifacts to help. And I did find a couple things that are helpful, right? One of the things that's interesting, though, is Amethyst, when it creates a scheduled task, it utilizes a legitimate library, which is, I don't know if this is the legitimate name of it because I thought it was weird, but it was a funnycat.microsoft.win32.taskscheduler.dll. And what's interesting about calling a library to do a scheduled task or create a scheduled task is it's not running the SCH tasks, the standard executable that's typically used. So if people are monitoring for unusual scheduled tasks that way by looking at the key executables that do it, this is a way where they kind of sidestepped that. So still kind of hard to see, but it'd be interesting if you see a new scheduled task being created and not an execution of a task. So there are Windows events that cater to that, but you also can monitor registry where scheduled tasks get dropped and see if new keys are created and you don't see the execution. And then the other thing I did find that is worth noting is once the program is actually executed, it deletes itself. And one of the things it does is it runs CMD slash C for command, and it is a choice statement. And choice is almost like a way to kind of delay, essentially. And it has a bunch of arguments after choice, and then three, which I think is the time. I don't know if it's 3 seconds or 3 minutes. I'm pretty sure it's 3 seconds. And then it does an and delete to whatever path of the executable file is. So it's a way to kind of like, after it gets running, tries to delete itself because it's going to be running from or moved or whatever it does. But a couple of things you could look for. But overall, the big thing for me was seeing so much information that I was really hopeful on, and then realized that the most of the information wasn't usable from a threat hunting perspective. So yeah, what was your take when you saw this?
So there were a couple things that stood out to me. The first one being, stepping back a little bit, is that it would leverage a user agent string that began with the word Brussels, which they marked as presumably the campaign ID. So that had my brain going a little bit on, you know, possibilities for looking at or trying to investigate off of user agent strings. Another thing that stood out to me, and this was more of a question, I guess, because I was kind of, I'm trying to think about why this would be relevant. So in one of the checks, because it does do a lot of different checks across a lot of registry read, right? The one that it checked to see if VM associated registry keys had been modified inside of the last month. And there was quite a long list of keys that it would look for, and specifically looking to see if it has been recently modified. I was kind of curious what you thought of why that might be.
Yeah, so my guess is they might be keying off, and this is just my assumption, because a lot of times, for instance, if you run a sandbox that's dedicated to looking at malware, you're running off snapshots. And so what my assumption is if it's a real, because, you know, let's be honest, just because something's a virtual environment doesn't mean it's not a good target. Like, a lot of virtual environments are used in corporate environments, enterprise environments, right? Just to actually, that's where they run things, right? It's, there's reliability there, there's redundancy there, and things like that. So I think they look for the modified time, because if you're running a real environment, those keys must get touched with some regular intervals. But if you're always restoring from a snapshot, then, and you compare it to the current date versus the previous date, obviously they're going to be stagnant and not have been touched or modified in a while. So that would be my best guess there.
Yeah. So thinking that they're trying to see if you know, identify if they are in a sandbox environment, not just the virtual environment.
Right. Like a legitimate virtual environment or sandbox, like the comparison there.
Oh, that kind of makes sense. Oh, it's pretty interesting. No, this is a good one, Scott. There's a lot of meat in this, but yeah, I see your point though. Cause when I was looking through it, I'm like, yeah, a lot of these, you know, I don't know how easily you'd be able to see a lot of the stuff that's going on here from a threat hunting perspective, or is it reasonable to try to log these things?
Right. Now, that being said, there is some unique logging you can turn on via WMI, but it's not an easy log to manage because I think once it collects so much, it stops itself. So you have to have a way to like roll it off and manage it, but you can turn on events for that. The other thing, I'm glad you brought up the Brussel thing for the user agent. So we talked earlier about user agents, and one of a good catch, I think, for unique user agents is go off length and something that's shorter than, because most browser user agents are pretty long. But you get weird ones from like Python or curl or, in this case, this malware campaign, right? And they're relatively short, but they're ones you want to pay attention to. So that's, I think, an easy cut to say, hey, let's just look for things like this. That I think are worth noting. All right.
Awesome.
So what do you got for us now?
All right. So moving on here. This one is, you know, likely a little shorter, a little less on the specific technical detail, but something I thought was thought-provoking. And certainly felt worth talking about. So this is an article from Sentinel Labs titled Akira Bot, an AI-powered bot that bypasses captures and spams websites at scale. So a couple of, and I'm going to kind of cite a little bit of the summary from the article directly because I think it summarizes it a little better than I probably could. Akira Bot, it's a framework used to spam website chats and contact forms and masks to promote a low-quality SEO service. So Sentinel Labs had assessed that the Akira bot had targeted more than 400,000 websites and successfully spammed at least 80,000 websites. This dates back to September of 2024. So the framework is modular and sophisticated compared to typical spam tools, employing multiple captcha bypass mechanisms and network detection evasion techniques. So an example of this is what they identified, the use of files found for capture-related servers and browsers that act like fingerprints that aid in helping bypass that capture piece, which I thought was pretty interesting. The bot also uses OpenAI to generate custom outreach messages based on the purpose of the website. So kind of walking down this is, you know, the general overview of the use that was identified, I don't think is necessarily scary, but some of the techniques are something I think we should consider and look out for, especially when we're talking about, you know, conversations of what kind of AI functionality could aid attackers, right? The functionality inside of this, the basic, you know, they're going into websites, they're looking for these open forums. They seem to primarily be in this specific campaign or operation, they seem to primarily be targeting smaller or mid-sized businesses that are using, you know, development sites like, you know, Squarespace and Wix and things like that, GoDaddy, where you can kind of easily stand up a generic website. And they're spamming the contact forms, the chat boxes inside of the websites to, you know, to kind of pump up SEO levels for, you know, various reasons. And part of this, you know, kind of led to the idea that this could be a very functional, this is, you know, my thought process here, Scott, this could be a very functional use for SEO poisoning. We kind of briefly started talking about that before we kicked off the podcast this morning. So I'll let you expand a little bit on that because I think it was originally your thought. But the other side is like the use of OpenAI. So basically what they're doing is they're hard coding API keys into their functionality so they can apply different unique messages each time paired with this captcha evasion that basically allows the spam to really flow through our, you know, what common protections are there specifically for these kind of sites that let you kind of stand up websites pretty quickly. And there's quite a few people that use these websites, right? They're very popular. GoDaddy, Wix, Squarespace, the few that I mentioned, super popular. So a lot of people spinning up websites on this, and the use of this kind of functionality targeting those those smaller, medium businesses. You know, it's got my brain thinking, Scott. It's like, you know, this is a actual demonstrable use of AI for how it can be leveraged by, you know, bad actors, right? Or people with malicious intent. But, you know, overall, you know, nothing overwhelmingly crazy here. I just really thought this technique was interesting. And I'm kind of curious what your thoughts were.
Yeah, so I found this fascinating for a couple of reasons. One, you know, I think everybody in the industry is kind of unanimous on agreeing that the AI or the chat AI type stuff is really going to help drive social engineering, right? Like that was kind of a no-brainer. This makes it easier to basically develop and also potentially cater the message a little better to targets. But I feel like this is almost like social engineering for technology, because that's kind of how SEO works, right? It's like, it's basically a search engine optimization so that when you're looking for things, hopefully the things that bubble up are the things that are the most popular or most relevant. And that's kind of the purpose of it. And so obviously there's business reasons to want to be at the top as far as, hey, I want people to go to my site because that generates ad revenue and other things. So however I can get that edge, that's important. So when thinking about this, one, I've never thought about the different ways or areas they're posting on sites like the chats and other things as actually being involved in SEO at all. Like I didn't think that one search engines, when they crawled, they actually crawled into that space, which I find interesting because I feel like maybe they shouldn't. For one, but also the fact that they are able to kind of also social engineer through that so that even if they are putting things in areas where people might be reading, they're providing things that can be clicked on and the clicks themselves can help promote sites. But I think this also leverages in a way from a malicious intent, if it's not just to get an edge from the business perspective, like you just want to generate revenue for your site for whatever reason, and you're kind of caught up in this campaign from a malicious intent. You know, you have SEO poisoning, and then I'd almost kind of dub it if it doesn't already exist, like SEO positioning. Poisoning would be where somehow you're able to, get a legitimate, like get the search engine to promote your malicious site, which usually mimics in naming conventions similar to legitimate site. So that instead of offering, say you're looking for a specific tool like PuTTY and you want to go download PuTTY real quick, you know what PuTTY is, and you go to a site that looks like PuTTY, but it's the first thing that pops up when you search it because there's been so much activity that SEO has put the malicious site ahead of the legitimate one. That's the poisoning technique. So maybe this could be leveraged in that extent. But from SEO positioning, there's a lot of technology that tries really hard to basically determine if you go to websites, what's the legitimacy of those sites. And it does through in many different ways with like categorization, with reputation and things like that. Well, obviously, if you can use this mechanism to maybe get sites you intend to use and you want to get the reputation higher and better, more legitimate looking, especially over time, I think you can leverage this in a similar fashion too, right? Because if you go up in rank essentially, then you seem to look more or less malicious. So I thought that was interesting because I haven't really thought of it from that perspective. And also, like, you know, CAPTCHA, it's amazing how a lot of time is spent to evade CAPTCHA. Obviously, CAPTCHA apparently must be a good defense if a lot of effort's being put into it, but also it seems very beatable now with some of the AI approaches.
Yeah, for sure. And the, you know, it was kind of, this is just more of a fun thing because I thought it was fun the way they approached it. But while leveraging OpenAI, they kind of assigned the script role for the AI bot. Like, you are a helpful assistant that generates marketing messages. And then it kind of like has the Python script for the bot has that functionality where it'll actually scrape the website for keywords to kind of like help it transform that code into LLM readable text to kind of make those so unique that it just really never appears as spam, especially like, you know, let's say you're hitting 500 GoDaddy websites, right? And we're not hitting them with the same message, has a hard time picking that up. It's just kind of cool to think about. It's like, you know, you don't want to give the bad guys too much credit, but also it's interesting, you know, interesting approach. All right, Scott, what do you got last for us this week?
All right, I'm going to end on a doozy. There's a lot packed in this one, but it's from SecureList.com, so it's associated with Kaspersky. It's Gafi APT new attacks. So Gafi, I don't know how I'm supposed to say that. It's one of the actors that they track, obviously Kaspersky being a Russian-based kind of security firm. Gafi, they focus on the Russian Federation as far as their attack base. So they kind of walk through some of like how they've watched them mature over the past few years and stuff like that, what they've done. But then their latest attack, as they dive into it, there's a lot of really interesting things, and a lot of, I guess, ways to kind of break up their traditional mechanisms that I would say we commonly look for as security practitioners. But in the past, you know, one of the things they focused on was when they compromised a site, they had a modified OWOA. It's a malicious ISS module. So there's a trend there, because I'll get into it, but they seem to also like to take legitimate executables and things and modify them. So they're the same executable, but adding functionality that they can leverage, which takes some sophistication when you think about it, right? You have to kind of understand how to break things apart, add things to it, and then recompile it in such a way. So when, like, just as recently as 2024, they did similar things, but they took a patched version of Explorer.exe, right? The main executable for your user interface in Windows. And they would basically drop it via spear phishing. And they utilized PowerTaskL, which is a non-public Mythic agent. So Mythic is a C2 framework, publicly available. And there's even some, you know, modules you can leverage for that. They basically developed their own agent. It is based on the Medusa public agent from the code base, some similarities there, but it's basically written in PowerShell, right? And so they also have a new implant they dubbed Power Module without the E, that, you know, is leveraging more PowerShell-based things. And the areas that were kind of targeted in general, it seems like a widespread. They were hitting the media and telecommunications, construction, governments, energy, within the Russian Federation stuff. So kind of the original, see if I got this marked in a way. Yeah, so the first case, they basically were using a phishing RAR that would basically drop the patched explorer.exe or the XP search view, XPSRCHVW.exe, basically to kind of add that functionality. It would do a bunch of different things. But the second case is when it gets a little more interesting, when some of their phishing campaigns, the second one, they actually dropped a doc with a macro in it. Now, what's interesting is the macro doesn't actually run anything, but it loads a key into Windows registry. So in the current user Hive software, Microsoft Windows NT current version, Windows registry, it puts in a registry key that's load equals and then has a path to an HTA file, which actually causes this to launch. So this is what was weird to me, is it says it doesn't launch anything, but then it causes this to launch. And my guess is you won't see the Office document as the parent in this case. You'll see Windows launching this because of where it's actually dropping things. So that part was interesting. So then it launches HTA, so it's going to use MSHTA. But some other things it does, you know, just kind of stealthy things there. But it also runs a command prompt at some point in the chain, and it passes a big whole stream of text, which is interesting, where it looks for basically an LNK file, but it's not really an LNK. It's a JavaScript file. And it does like the CMD/C, like it's going to run a command and does the if not exist. That's how it starts. That to me is stands out significantly because that I wouldn't expect to see in many fashions. It's unique, but also shows there's a lot of thought going into this attack where it's saying, I want to do some checks before running versus just failing when it tries to run, right? So it basically is determining where it's going to then, you know, do some PowerShell even off of the JavaScript. So there's some chaining there that you'll be able to see. And I'll get into some of the process chains that kind of get brought out at the end of the article. But one of the other things that was interesting too is there is a direct call out to an IP. And in the actual URL, that's where they pass a lot of the computer name, username, and serial number. So interesting thing when you're looking at URLs, obviously direct IP callouts, are good to look for, but it's interesting. There's information passed, that way. And then, so then that kind of a tool breakdown. So they use the Power Module, like I mentioned before, and Power Module itself was supposed to basically, pass and orchestrate the Power Taskle, which I mentioned was the Mythic 2 agent. They have a flash file grabber. They have offline and online version of that and a USB worm tool. So starting with file grabber, the offline version basically is a way to grab files. And it can work offline, but it also will look at removable media files. So anything that connects to something. So for instance, maybe a machine goes offline. Maybe it's in a secure environment, so it doesn't have connectivity that way. This is something where it can grab files for where USBs might be passed, because that's a lot of times how those environments are managed. So it's thinking about the environment when it comes to grabbing these files. And then I'm sure depending on how things move or how things connect, it tries to move those off in other ways, or they do it manually if they have connectivity with the agent. But they drop these files in the temp directory, cache store, connect directory. So that's where it tries to move all those things. So it creates a bunch of directories there. And the online version of file stash grabber actually just, it can send the files directly to the C2. The USB worm component, this is where it tries to copy itself to removal media. And it names itself with a random name and gives itself the hidden attribute. So it tries to kind of hide there. But also when it copies itself over, it creates a hidden VBS and batch file to launch the Power Module. So you'll see where it has in the VBS script example, it actually launches WScript, right? And then that WScript itself creates a .bat and a .docx, kind of like a fake file in the drive. So that's something good to know, is what files are actually being created by WScript. That'd be something to look for. And especially if WScript is creating other script-based files, or even just creating Office document files. Not normal, right? But the VBS contents, when it runs as well, it runs PowerShell. So you kind of have that script-to-script chaining, I like to call it. And that also, when you see PowerTaskle, I mentioned it's similar to Medusa, the public agent. But one of the interesting things about its lateral movement within PowerTaskle, within that agent, right, that Mythic agent, it drops PS exec, usually renamed. In the instance they're looking at, it was renamed as NT user. And it launches an MSHTA as system and passes a URL. This is kind of how it moves its payloads across. It uses a lot of MSHTA to grab payloads through all the technical detail they provide, which is, it's good to pay attention to that, because I do see a lot of MSHTA being leveraged, but obviously it's something that either tools or people don't look at enough, that may be trending because of that. So the example of some of the process chaining that was mentioned, kind of summarizing a lot of this that I talked through. So when we talk about the initial foothold, there is the use of PSExec. So they use a renamed version of PSExec, like I mentioned, which typically will launch PowerShell to launch MSHTA. MSHTA typically will launch command prompt and C script. The C script will then launch PowerShell, which typically will run Who Am I, you know, to get the host stuff, and then execute PowerTaskle to get that Mythic agent running, which then uses the system info in the CSE-EXE, which is kind of our compile some things to run, probably associated with PowerShell, and then the Mythic agent. And so you can see just in that whole chain I mentioned, there's a lot of this scripting tool launching, this scripting tool launching, this scripting tool, like a pretty long chain of that, which is kind of highly suspicious in a lot of regards. And in the Mythic Agent, one of the things it does, like I mentioned before, it uses the Windows Microsoft Remote Management, WSMAN. They saw that from the user agent or the call out. Basically, it's launching MSHTA for distribution to connect remotely and download what it wants to download. So they have some examples of either the WMIPRVSE or WSMPRVHost.exe. Basically running the same thing. It's going to be either CMD/MSHTA being executed or just straight MSHTA as a child of that. And with a full domain and then a pretty much long URL string with the .hta. And they will also run CMD to run PowerShell to run MSHTA if they want to as well. So there's different variations, but it's still script to script to script. Example, like I mentioned, except for the one instance where they call it MSHTA directly with the remote management. So obviously there's a lot there, technical details, and they have some snippets of code to kind of look for. So I'm sure even just digging into some of the artifacts within the code that you can see run from a command line, there might be additional things to look for. But I think what I really liked about this was there's just a level of sophistication here. Even though there's common things I called out, like the script to script to script type different executions, or the script interpreters, that's just good to look for, even from sophisticated or unsophisticated. I think that's a great way to find interesting activity. And then also looking what's being passed to the script interpreters, you know, is it a URL or IP or a script itself, you know, also worth looking at. Those I think would help in this case and even in some of the previous cases we've talked about. So I think it's worth looking at. There's a lot of good stuff that, like I said, I'm probably not calling out, but it's really in depth as far as how they covered this. So what were your thoughts?
Yeah, you know, a couple things, because there is a lot of depth here, but I'm just going to hit a couple bullets that I kind of marked for, you know, from a threat hunting perspective, right? So they talk about, you know, this is what my mind is thinking right now, working through this article, like these are things I could potentially look at to hunt. So let's say I'm in my environment, not necessarily something that I've thought about before or have looked at recently. But the first one is, you know, the use of a double file extension. So I find this one interesting, and this has my mind thinking a little bit. So you like when you see, like they give examples of this, but this should be uncommon. You shouldn't see this very often. But what I'm talking about is like when you see files created that are like .lnk.js. So, right, your LNK file, JavaScript file, those things kind of combine, things like that. So those double extensions, I think those always stand out and are worth investigating and usually pretty easy to find. The other part that I was looking at, and you talked a lot about the MSHTA, and I think you kind of like glossed over this a couple times. I was just going to throw another nail at it. But the one of the specific uses of that, from what my mindset's thinking about, is where you see like NT user .exe being the parent of MSHTA.exe, right? So something non-standard kicking off the MSHTA process, you know, typically... I'm trying to go off through some. I think like Explorer, SVC host, MSI exec, you know, some in some a lot of cases CMD or PowerShell, maybe WScript for legacy stuff. And then like
yeah, I don't know why
your scheduled tasks. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I said I don't know why they use NT user. Like I know this PS exec under the hood, but like I don't know why they masqueraded NT user, because I thought that was a weird choice.
Yeah. It seems that, I don't know, in my mind, it would stand out. Like, if you're thinking about the MSHTA process, like there's some common ones, like, you know, common ones that will kick it off. But outside of that, it's a pretty small bucket of what's common for that. If you see things outside of that, it's a pretty easy tripwire that you can go look for from a threat hunting perspective. Also, you know, just keeping up with the theme of the morning from my perspective, Scott, you know, hey, I got another user agent marker here, right? So they talked about the non-standard value being inside of the user agent header. It's a Ruby WinRM client that kind of gives some notice to say, what's this thing trying to do, right? Tiny little artifact that would stand out in my mind if I'm looking at the user agent stuff. But yeah, so, you know, just three little bullets that I thought were interesting.
Yeah, the one interesting thing about that user agent is I believe that was seen laterally, and that is something to note when people talk about where they collect their telemetry or how their monitoring works. You know, if you're only looking at traffic, you know, at the edge, you might miss things like that. So there is, like, if depending on where you collect data, if there's a really good discussion about strategy there and cost, obviously. But keep in mind on those types of things too, where there might be weird stuff going on internally that you just might not have visibility to. But obviously the data exists. So.
Yeah, no, great point. Maybe that's something we should dive into a little more too. Things that we, you know, maybe we talk about and not think about, like what looks at the edge stuff versus, you know, east west.
Even like a large discussion on. I was just gonna say like a large discussion on just visibility, like what strategically gives you the most bang for your buck, kind of thing. Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we get a little headstrong on the north-south traffic and tend to forget about the east-west.
Mm-hmm.
No, good article. There's a lot here. You weren't lying.
Yeah, no, it took me a while. So just some call-outs before we close out here. We are going to do our Out of the Woods live podcast May 8th from 12 to 1:30 p.m. Now, this is going to be a fun one, right? We're actually doing what we call a Guess Who, the adversary edition. The concept here is we're going to take an adversary and walk through all the TTPs and how to hunt, things to know about them and everything, but we're not going to tell you who they are. So the concept, hopefully, if you're listening to it live, is hopefully based on the information we're providing, you might be able to make some guesses and see if you can kind of get it right. And see if you understand the adversary the same way we do. So definitely attend, if not, definitely catch back up, because if it's an adversary you're interested in, it might be a good source of information for you. So with that, really want to thank everyone for joining our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast. Looking forward to syncing back up next week. So that closes out our top threat hunting headlines for the week of April 15th, 2025. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everybody.